This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And welcome to the big picture. Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler sitting here. You know, over the years, our technicians have been talking about the various phases in bull markets, three up phases and two corrective phases. And we seem to be entering the final phase of this bull market. This month, by the way, marks the eighth anniversary of the bull market. So the question is now, if this is a final phase, what does the final phase look like? Are there any further gains ahead for investors despite rate hikes? And what will it be like when the market comes to an end? Prophesy the end, oh great one. So let's do that, Jim.
Well, I mean, usually in the third phase, which is probably one of the strongest phases, if you can think back of the bull market that ended in 2007, 2006, 2007 were very strong years for the market, just as, let's say, 1998 to 2000 were very strong years. So the final phase of the bull market can be very powerful and explosive. And a lot of the technicians that we have in the program, and even some of the strategists that we've had here on the program recently, including Barry Bannister, believes there's a good possibility that the S&P 500 could hit 2,500. I know Craig Johnson believes we're headed for 2,424 on the S&P 500. And as we talked about in the first hour with Dave Nikoski from Vermilion, I asked Dave, I said, you know, if we were having this conversation December 31st, do you expect stock prices higher than where they are now? And he said, yes. So a very strong possibility, John, despite all the difficulties and despite some of the pullbacks that we've seen, or let's say consolidation that we've seen, we haven't really seen a severe pullback here. You know, we've had a pullback of 1% or 2%. That's hardly anything. But they do expect stocks to head higher from here.
Yeah, but we've been talking about Fed rate hikes over the past X number of shows. It's obvious that that's on the horizon. So how does that factor in?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about this, we've discussed the three steps and a stumble rule, Edson Gold, every time the Fed raises interest rates three times, they did. The market pulled back a little bit, but not much. But you have to understand, as Dave talked about in the first hour, we're starting for a very low base. The Fed funds rate is at 1% right now. After this latest hike, that's exactly where we began raising interest rates in 2004 when Greenspan began raising rates all the way up to the 2006 period. So if you study intermarket relationships, believe it or not, what you generally see in that final phase is you see rising interest rates go hand in hand with rising stock prices and also rising commodity prices. Now, what's going on? What does that mean fundamentally? Well, if you are in the final phase of an economic cycle where the economy begins to heat up, inflation begins to heat up at that time, why? Energy prices, commodity prices are rising. What does that mean? We have more inflation. Inflation is picking up. That translates into further Fed rate hikes. So if you look at an economic cycle, the inflation that comes with it, and it heats up, rising interest rates, rising commodity prices go hand in hand with higher stock prices. And as I mentioned, we're starting at a low point right now. Even after three rate hikes, we're still only at 1%. So if you look at a 1% Fed funds rate, interest rates are still accommodative. And so that is still good for the stock market right now. Rates have gone up since November or last summer, but if you look at them historically in terms of where they've been in the past, interest rates are very, very low.
So let's assume that you're right. We're in the final phase. What are you watching closely?
Right now, the things I'm watching commodities, especially copper and oil, and I'm also watching interest rates. You know, when we hit a peak of about 2.6% on the 10-year note, and as that note began to decline, so did stock prices. Now interest rates are heading back up. The stock market is heading back up. And what I'm watching very closely to confirm this final phase is what happens in the commodity markets. And I think there are two commodities that are especially important to watch. One is copper, called Dr. Copper, and the other one is oil prices. And even though we've seen a dip recently from the mid-50s down to around $48 a barrel, oil prices this Friday back up over 50, the present drop is not seen in a deflationary sense, like, for example, what we saw happen in the fall of 2014 when we were over $100 a barrel, dropping all the way to $26 a barrel last year. I do believe that oil prices are headed higher. Very, very strong incentive for Saudi Arabia, which is going public with an IPO of Saudi Aramco next year. Probably one of the most expensive IPOs in history. Valuing the Saudi company could have a value at close to $1 trillion. Boy, that would even exceed Apple and Google. And there's also a widespread belief, and I think this will happen, that the OPEC cuts will be extended into the second half of the year. So one of the reasons oil has strengthened is a lot of Libyan oil has come off production. Prior to the overthrow of Gaddafi, Libya was exporting 1.6 million barrels a day. They're down to roughly about 500,000 barrels a day. Several of their terminals have been cut and stopped as a result of military conflict in the region. So a couple things we're watching for to confirm this, John. The price of oil, the price of copper, interest rates, all three should confirm each other. And of course, the LEIs as well. One of the things that we've seen here is as the Fed recently raised interest rates for the third time, but we're into this rate raising cycle. We've been in it now for a couple of years. If you really take a look at 2014, when the Fed began taper, was really when this rate raising cycle really began. So we're already into our third year into this cycle, because in May of 2014, the shadow Fed funds rate was close to negative 3%. Now we're at a Fed funds rate of 1%. So we're about 3 years into this cycle. And even though the markets are considering two more rate hikes this year, if you look at the Fed futures market right now, they're anticipating another rate hike coming as soon as June. And I think as we'll get into topic number two today, hard versus soft data on the LEIs, I think they'll be somewhat cautious, see how this rate hike has played out. But it's widely expected if things continue, and especially if the stock market does well, the Fed will raise in June and most likely either November or December of this year with two more rate hikes, which would take the Fed funds rate up to about 1.5%.
Are there any risks that you foresee with these rate hikes, either later this year or next year?
You know, I think we can handle two more rate hikes, but I think as we get into the second half of the year, especially after the second rate hike, it'll be interesting to see if we follow this economic pattern that we have seen throughout this economic recovery. We see weakness beginning in the fourth quarter, carried over into the first quarter. And I believe that's what you're going to see when we report first quarter GDP numbers for next month. If you just take a look at some of the LEIs and some of the weakness, we're probably tracking closer to 1% versus 2% on GDP. So I think as we get towards the end of this year, probably in the fourth quarter, you should see some weakness begin to emerge in the, not only the stock market itself, but also in the LEIs. But I don't think the risk of recession is a 2017 issue. I think the risk of a recession is a 2018 issue. Currently, we've been in sort of a consolidation phase here in the market, as our technicians have pointed out. But three things that we're starting to see. We're starting to see inflation on the rise, interest rates are on the rise, and we're going to see earnings on the rise. And that's going to come mainly from two sectors that can increase S&P earnings this year. And that's from very, very depressed levels. And two sectors in particular, the energy sector. You got to remember, last year we got prices down to 26. We're now close to 50. So look for upgrades in the energy sector and financials. And that should be enough to fuel stock market prices higher, because the next catalyst for the market has to come from corporate earnings. And I could see that coming in two forms. Either one, increased earnings from energy in the financial sector. And number two, if we get a corporate tax cut, we'll get into that later on, that could also help corporate earnings. So that's where I see the specifics in terms of what could be the catalyst for driving stock prices higher.
Okay, what about now commodity prices? You know, if we look at oil, say, for example, it seems to be within pretty much of a trading range. So if we look at oil or copper or something like that, how do they factor?
Well, I mean, if you take a look at from the election, when the stock prices took off, we also saw an increase in the price of energy and an increase in the price of copper. Lately, they've been going sideways, consolidating. But if, for example, we talked about one of our mega trends of infrastructure, that would bode well for copper. It would also bode well for energy. And so what we're looking for right now is for strength of the global economic recovery. There are two key commodities we're watching that are, I think, play a major factor in terms of confirming economic trends. That's oil and copper. If the economy picks up, which I expect, in the second quarter and third quarter, then I would expect to see higher oil prices and copper confirm that trend in the economy. And we're watching, for example, and paying close attention, we'll get into detail in another topic today, we're watching new orders on the ISM minus inventory. So if you got a lot more new orders coming in and you're working down your inventory, what does that tell us? It tells you you're going to have to increase production to match new orders. So we're watching that. Other factors that we're looking at is we're taking a look at what's going on in the PMIs. And as Dave talked about in the first hour, our technician, he talked about the international markets are picking up and are in sync with U.S. markets. So we're watching PMIs globally in the large developed economies, not only Japan. We're watching what's going on in Europe. That's picking up. China's picking up. Global PMIs are picking up, which would bode well. And you're seeing that reflected in outperformance of some of these international markets, which Dave commented on. The other thing that we're also looking at is what's going on with corporate earnings. And we could see an increase in corporate earnings coming, as I mentioned, from two very, very depressed areas, and that is energy and financials. And so those are, you know, John, some of the things that we're watching and paying close attention to confirm this, what we call the final phase of the market.
But by the time we arrive at the end of the year, and we're anticipating two more rate hikes by then, we could also say, I guess, we're getting into the danger zone, which is where we would get in 2018.
Yeah, by the end of the year, I think by the time we get to the third rate hike and also the seasonality that we see where the economy begins to slow in the fourth quarter and the first quarter, you know, you might start to see maybe the advanced decline line start to decline as fewer and fewer stocks start to participate. Usually towards the end of a bull market, you start seeing the large cap stocks start to outperform and fewer industries or sectors participate. In other words, leadership in the market begins to narrow. But I do think the end game is 2018. I think once you get past 1.5% on the Fed funds rate, I think the Fed is going to have a lot of difficulty getting the Fed funds rate over 2%. So I'm looking, at least from what we're seeing in this cycle, probably a danger point at the end game between 2018 and 2019. And that is where we're going to be paying very close attention. But right now, everything, whether you're looking at momentum, the advanced decline line, the widespread, you know, what the old saying, a rising tide lifts all boats. And you can see that across all sectors within the S&P. And you're also starting to see for the first time, the international markets begin to fire up.
Since we're always concerned from an investment standpoint, Jim, what would you expect to do well during this final phase? I know Dave Nikoski mentioned a couple of sectors. What do you see?
You know what? I would expect to see a pickup in energy, materials, cyclical stocks, and consumer discretionary. And I would also expect, John, to see a pattern that we've talked about here in terms of how markets top out. The first sector to top out is the bond market. I believe that's already taken place. The second sector would be the stock market. So I would expect as we get towards the end of the year, we're going to see some weakening, very similar to what we saw in 2017 when the market peaked in October. It was still positive for the year, But by October of 2007, the market was starting to weaken. And then the final sector to peak would be commodities. And we saw this reflected in the bear market of 2000 and the bear market of 2007. And the other thing that I also would expect to see, and it's something that you see towards the end of a bull market, where you see energy begin to lead with higher energy prices being reflected in not only inflation in the economy, but also rising interest rates, but also simultaneously a movement into consumer staples, because a lot of market participants begin to see the weakening economy, and also they begin to see the narrowness of leadership in the market. So investors anticipating and fund managers begin to get defensive and start moving into, let's say, things like consumer staples, things like utilities, expecting further weakness in the market. But anyway, energy does very well, and that would probably be the last sector to peak, would be commodities. So I would look for rising energy prices and rising consumer staples to confirm we're closer to the end. But the other thing that's going to be interesting is if you take a look at President Trump's agenda, he's talking about appealing Obamacare. That failed last Friday, although there's talk about resurrecting it. They're moving on to tax reform. He's moving ahead with regulatory reform through his cabinet and executive orders. And then he's also moving towards infrastructure. And I really don't think infrastructure here in the U.S. is going to be the issue until about 2019 and 2020, which would be if the economy was in a recession. You know, once the economy starts to weaken, then I think you're going to see broad spread agreement between both political parties to spend money, and infrastructure would become a major theme somewhere around 2019 and 2020. And I think at that point, you're going to see a regime shift away from this disinflation, deflationary cycle that we've been in since the Great Recession. And that's going to be driven by fiscal stimulus with the Federal Reserve buying up the government's bonds, in other words, financing the deficit, or what some have called helicopter money. And, but I think that's further down the road after the next recession.
So then, as you're looking at things right where we are right now, what is it you're actually seeing? And I'm saying this in the light of what you would be doing in particular right now and what you might want to have happen, whether we're in a, just a consolidation or actually something more serious.
Well, I mean, we're following a number of things. If you take a look at investor sentiment is at a high level, consumer confidence is at a high level, and investor confidence is being reflected with rising margin debt. It is very elevated at the point. Something that would signal a problem is as rates continue to rise, if margin debt begins to recede, if it does, if you have to close out a margin account, what that means is you're selling off your stock holdings. And so we're watching investor confidence along with margin debt. We're also taking a look at the rise in interest rates. He has put a damper somewhat on M&A activity, because before, with rates before they began to rise, and especially last summer when we saw rates fall down to record levels, we were seeing a lot of M&A activity, which could be financed with, let's say, lower price debt. We're also following the economic numbers, and we'll get into that, which have softened recently, reflecting that seasonal pattern that we've seen throughout this recovery, where the economy begins to slow down in the fourth quarter and the first quarter. The other thing that we're seeing here, which is telling us also what companies are doing, is we're seeing the rise in temporary employment. It continues to rise, and we would watch for shrinkage. That would indicate that companies are beginning to pull back. But one of the things that you're seeing is the rise in temp workers. Part of that is they are easier to let go if the economy begins to weaken. And number two, under Obamacare, if you can keep workers to under 30 hours, you don't have to cover them under expensive medical policies, especially if you're a company that has more than 50 employees. So we're watching temporary employment. And then also we're watching the performance of consumer staples. To consumer discretionary stocks are very, very strong right now. So that indicates we're still on this positive up move that Dave Nikoski talked about in the first hour, because 70% of the U.S. economy is consumption.
All right. So now that we've outlined the situation, what is it as a firm that you're doing for your clients in this environment?
Well, as I mentioned last week on the show, we're not 100% invested in stocks. You know, depending on the accounts, we're either 70 to 80% in stocks or 20 to 30% in bonds right now. And I suspect as the markets head higher, the percentage of stocks will decrease as we'll begin to take profits off the table. And, you know, the other thing we're doing right now, which we think is going to work out well, is what do we know? We know the Fed is going to be raising interest rates, widely anticipated. Two more rate hikes this year. Some are even saying four if the economy really heats up. What we're doing is participating in floating rate bonds, which we think is probably the play to be in right now because we can participate as rates begin to rise. Then the rates on those bonds begin to rise. It also is a way to get some capital gains. We still like dividend paying stocks. In our growth accounts, we're probably more oriented towards technology as a sector. As Dave talked about, that one of the leadership sectors that we've seen, especially coming out of the November 8th elections, has been technology. You can see that in the price of Google. You can see it in the price of Amazon, Netflix, Apple stock, which are all hitting new highs and new records. So, John, right now, there's still a lot of play left in this market. But I think towards the end of the year, we should begin to see some softness. And 2018, I think, is the year to be concerned. But I think right now, as you take a look at this economy, there's very little chance of recessionary risk in 2017, unless there's something that happens that we don't foresee. And two things that could happen is a sharp spike in interest rates and a sharp spike in the dollar. That would put a quick stop to this market rise and put us in a severe correction and actually put us more in a defensive mode.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Many people thought that we were entering into a bear market, and the market is very good at kind of confusing and kind of misleading many people throughout the advance. And that's pretty much what happened in 2016 low. And then since then, we've had another strong advance. Markets up, you know, more than 20% since then. And in LA wave terminology, this would be the fifth wave. And in the fifth wave, as you and I discussed last time, this is when the macro data peaks and starts to decline. The corporate profitability starts to deteriorate and valuations become very high and sentiment becomes euphoric.
Okay, welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour and the Big Picture. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. We were talking about the final phase of the bull market. What we would like to do in this segment is examine the data that are involved in this. But first, a couple of interesting tiddly bits here. Since November 8th, the Dow Jones is up 13%. S&P up 11%, NASDAQ 14.5%, and let's face it, ever since the election, the market has been euphoric on the basis of a number of election promises. Number one, tax cuts, which, by the way, 80% of the country is in favor of, and they're going to get more in favor of it as we're now in April, by the way, because now it's time to write the check.
Man, if I was the Republicans, I would go for it right now, because this is when people really become cognizant of what they're paying in taxes as they write those checks and file their
returns.
Yeah,
somebody said we should have our elections on April 20th every year, right after everybody's written the checks. And he said that would change the whole complexion of elections all along. My daughter and her husband said they were doing their taxes and it was mostly a lot of cussing. You know, it's not just doing the tax, but it's the pain you have to go through to fill out this labyrinth of forms, depending on what you're doing with investments in your business and everything else like that. So anyway, the country's in favor of that, and you can understand that. Infrastructure spending was another one of the promises, which we do need, especially in Atlanta. They're going to need a little bit of repair where that overpass collapsed due to the fire. Deregulation and appeal of Obamacare. Now, these were all election promises, remember that. And of course, that thing imploded this week, and even if it had passed, it was questionable as to what it would do. It was supposed to be like repeal and replace, not just simply a repeal. And remember, the president wrote in on a lot of these promises. But so far, the only thing we've gotten is a certain level of deregulation, notably in the EPA this week. So I think you feel that the market's probably gotten ahead of the fundamentals. In other words, they've been riding on a lot of euphoria. But what are the LEIs telling you, the leading economic indicators?
Well, you know, there's something that we often talk about, or analysts in the industry, and they talk about what is called hard data versus soft data. Hard data, when you're looking at economic facts, are things like GDP, things like business investment, consumption, wages. Soft data is sentiment surveys. And we know right now, for example, consumer confidence just hit a record in March, the highest level that we've seen in 16 years. Now, consumer confidence, NFIB, business survey confidence, these things are what we call soft data. So every month, we get economic reports. There's about 50 of them that are mainly reported on. Most of them are hard numbers, like the ISM manufacturing survey, the ISM service survey, industrial production, durable goods. And then you have things that we call soft data surveys, things like the Conference Board's consumer confidence, the Manpower Employment Survey, the NAHB Housing Index, the NFIB Small Business Survey, and the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Survey. Now, these are what we call soft sentiment. And they're important because when people feel optimistic, they're more likely to spend, they're more likely to invest if you're in business, or they're more likely to hire. And so the sentiment surveys, or what we call the soft part of economic data, have been very, very robust. However, when we get to the hard data, there is a wide chasm between what is called hard data and soft data. And what I'm referring to is GDP growth. We saw it slow down in the fourth quarter, and we're expecting weak numbers for the first quarter. Business investment has been weak, and consumption and wages. And the thing that we've seen since November 8th that has been behind the stock market's gains is Trump's election. And that has created this positive economic sentiment. And so because we had the policy trifecta, deregulation, tax cuts, and infrastructure, all of those are going to be positive for economic growth. But much of what we've seen in this market right now is moving on sentiment, or what I call soft data versus hard data. And the market reflects a lot of hope and optimism versus what we're seeing in some of the economic numbers. And once again, the best reflection of that is soft data, like the Consumer Confidence Board in March hit 125.6, and that's up from 116 in February, and it's the highest level we've seen in consumer confidence in 16 years. But the question is, can the soft data, which is sentiment and confidence, be translated into actual hard data, meaning spending and investment, which drives GDP growth?
Now, you have your own set of proprietary LEIs, and as you're co-tracking things with the standard set, how do you see in terms of weakness, like if we look back at fourth quarter of last year and first quarter of this year?
Well, I mean, we follow 19 LEIs here domestically, and we follow 4 internationally. And I would say right now, the strongest LEIs that we're following are overseas, especially in Europe, China, Japan, and Asia. Those are very, very strong right now. Of the 19 that we follow, 9 are in an uptrend, 1 is flat, and 18 have actually declined. So that would line up with pretty much what we've seen in this slowdown in economic growth that we saw in Q4. And we expect the numbers when they come out for Q1 to be very slow as well. Now, the question is, can this then turn around and turn up as it's done so frequently over the last 8 years? The strongest parts of the year in the economy are usually reflected in the second and third quarter. I expect, based on what we're seeing with what we call predictive indicators, these are actually running ahead of the LAIs, tell us that we start to see a pickup in the second and third quarter. Now, part of that is going to be reflected in what happens with credit, because right now the yield curve has sort of been flattening, and what you need is a steep yield curve for to make it profitable for banks. In other words, a steep yield curve means longer-term interest rates are higher than short-term interest rates. Now, long-term interest rates are determined by the market. Because there's such a wide spread in interest rates in the market right now between the U.S., remember, other central banks are still in the quantitative easing mode, although I think Europe and Japan are moving closer to taper where the U.S. was back in 2014. So the rise in U.S. interest rates is creating a lot of inflows of foreign capital into this country. I mean, I can look at a 10-year treasury note. Let's round it off and say it's 2.4%. If I look at Germany, a German 10-year treasury note is probably about 33 basis points or one-third of 1%. If I look at 10-year Japanese notes, they're about 7 basis points. Now, you know, one of the areas that we're investing in is we're investing in a very active fund manager that is shorting overseas sovereign debt. You know, it's hard to believe that last year at this time, most interest rates on sovereign debt, about a third of it, was negative. But, you know, if you're an international investor, you're an institution, you're a central bank, where do you want to put your money? Do you want to put your money in the U.S. where you can make 2.4%? Or do you want to put your money in Germany when you make one-third of 1%? Or less than 0.1% in Japan. So a lot of that is keeping a lid on interest rates long term in the U.S. We expect them to rise by the end of the year, but not rapidly, because a lot of foreign money is still pouring into this country, which is putting a damper on interest rates rising. But for interest rates and for the economy to expand, a lot of it is going to depend on credit. And the latest loan officers survey shows that credit continues to be tightening here in the U.S., and we would look for that to change going forward. But right now, John, there is a widening gap between the hard data, which is what we just talked about, the LAIs, and the soft data. And if you take a look at, for example, some of the key investment variables, growth, residential investment has been stagnant. GDP growth has been around 1%. We expect that to be the same in the first quarter. Business investment has been anemic, and wages are somewhat sluggish. So we're going to have to see improvement in those areas going forward. And I think the next catalyst, at least in my opinion, is an improvement in the LAIs, which we could begin to see in Q2. And also next month, which begins next week, we're going to start to see corporate profits reported for the first quarter. They're expected to be heating up and improving, and that could be another catalyst for the market going forward. But right now, we've seen a pullback on M&A activity here, and that's reflecting rising interest rates. Also, we're still seeing a influx of money flowing into bond funds versus equities. And so those are things that we're monitoring. But right now, the hard data does not reflect the optimism that we're seeing in the soft data.
Well, I think one catalyst you think might provide an incentive going forward would be an increase in corporate profits. And how do you see that?
Well, I mean, two things that can cause S&P earnings to go up. I mentioned that the energy sector and the financial sector were the two weakest performing sectors last year. So if energy prices have gone up, remember, we were at $26 oil. Today, we're at $50. So that means profits for oil companies are going to increase. So you could see S&P earnings go up just on the basis of two sectors, the financial sector and the energy sector, which could represent almost 20% of S&P earnings. The second thing that you could see contribute to corporate profits is if the president and the Republicans move on tax reform and cut corporate tax rates. And let me give you an example of what this could mean in terms of S&P earnings. And let's just make this simple. Let's assume that a company earns $100 of profit and they have 100 shares outstanding. Now, if you make $100 in profits and the corporate tax rate is 35%, you make $65 profit after paying $35 in corporate income taxes. Let's say that the president, Republicans, reduce corporate taxes to a 20% rate to make us more competitive. Well, instead of paying 35%, a company only pays 20%. That means they get to keep $80 out of that $100 profits. The difference between 35% in corporate taxes and 20% in corporate taxes could be an increase in profits of 23%. So if we pass a reduction in corporate tax rates, which there seems to be widespread agreement, at least on corporate tax cuts, between Republicans and Democrats, because the U.S. has the most expensive tax rates in the world, that could also increase. So there's two possibilities. One, an increase in profits coming from the energy and financial sector. And secondly, tax cuts. But right now, John, the senior loan survey shows that lending standards are continuing to tighten, especially on commercial and industrial loans.
If we take a look at the hard and soft data, what would tell you that things are actually starting to change?
I would say probably a pickup in the LEIs would be number one. We've already seen a sharp pickup in LEIs overseas. And number two, I want to see commodity prices start to rise, especially copper and energy. So that's one of the reasons why we're still partially defensively allocated in our accounts. We do have growth stocks, but, you know, once again, we're not fully invested in stocks because we do believe this is the final phase. So going forward, what we want to see is an increase in the LEIs. And if we follow the typical pattern, we should see that begin to happen with a strong pickup in economic growth in the second and third quarter and a weakening by the time we get to the end of the year. But right now, John, there is a huge chasm between hard and soft data.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
You actually write that you think it is important to not just look at the leading, but it's also important to look at the coincident and the lagging as well. Why is that if you're looking in the rearview mirror?
Well, one reason is that, you know, a lot of stats get reconfigured after the fact, right? Even things as basic as GDP estimate will be revised down the line. So sometimes, you know, people create narratives about what happened in the economy that
turn out to be false.
Yeah, turn out to be false. Or again, to avoid the 0-1, that turn out to be exaggerated, to stress one aspect or another too much. Investors should be smart people, but also people who pay attention to details, right? Like Warren Buffett, he's not taking things for granted. He's looking back to the past a little bit to make sure that he understands where the economy is now. And of course, that's the stepping stone for trying to peer into the future to see where it's going to go.
And welcome back to the last part of the Big Picture on the Financial Sense News Hour today. Something we are going to call next war and peace is important to examine because it seems like the media in our country anyway, in addition to navel gazing, as I call it, we tend to watch our own issues intensely here to the expense of other things. But in addition to that, we are seeing trends outside of the U.S. to which they are deaf and blind, and yet they are going to affect us greatly. Over the last 7 years, for example, we've seen a rise in global conflicts, all right? Russia moved in Crimea. We had the civil war erupt in Syria after the what was called the Arab Spring turned out to be an Arab winter, and that decayed down. Conflicts going on in Libya, they're related to each other. Changes in Iraq. A lot of this is due to the rise of ISIS and terrorist attacks in the West, where for decades terrorism was confined to the Middle East. Now it's moved beyond that. The civil war in Syria is probably the hottest spot for right now. The U.S. is moving advisory troops into the region. We also have some of the latest controversies, so to speak, controversies with alleged Russian interference in the U.S. and or European elections. We're seeing turmoil in terms of Europe's changes in terms of populism and the Brexit. We've also seen aggressive missile testing by North Korea and Iran. I mean, they're capable right now. North Korea is capable of reaching the west coast of the United States. And the question is whether or not they can mount nuclear weapons on top of that. And our own defense systems, if you've been listening, I've been listening to a lot of the intelligence podcasts, Jim, that deal with this type of stuff. And we are singularly unprepared to meet these threats, especially we're very much exposed to electromagnetic pulse attacks and will be so. That was the latest estimate. There was a report that came out that we would be vulnerable to EMP attacks, which could really cripple parts or all of the country very seriously for the next 10 years. Okay. And we also see the U.S. retreating from its global commitments, creating a power vacuum. Now, to all of this, the media seem deaf and blind. As I've said, they are intense in this struggle to discredit. I mean, it's very clear that they have set out a course to discredit the current administration and the current president. And they are so intensely focused on that. These developments are developing around us and they will affect investments, economics, and of course, the security of much of the world. One of the trends, this is the trend that we really almost wanted to call a megatrend. Remember, we covered megatrends over the last couple of weeks on the show here, but we'll go ahead and cover it today. There's a global arms race between major powers outside of the U.S. And again, to all of this stuff that's going on, to a large degree, the intensity of it, the media tend to be just oblivious to this. And as a result, the American people are as well.
Yeah, there's a major shift in military spending, especially against our adversaries, particularly China and Russia. And if we take a look, there was a study that just came out in military expenditures on a global basis. China is moving. In 2015, they spent $146 billion on defense. In 2016, they accelerated that to $215 billion. Russia has moved from $66 billion to almost $67 billion. And then also you're seeing a big increase in defense spending in some of the Gulf states. For example, Saudi Arabia has gone from $81 billion to almost $87 billion. They are now spending almost 14% of GDP. Oman is increasing its military spending to almost 16% of GDP. Now, the U.S. is falling further behind in constant dollars, and we'll get into this, and it's probably my next article I'm going to write, because I've been following this because it's a trend we're looking at, and also taking a look at defense spending. But the U.S. spends roughly about $596 billion. Now, that's a lot of money. That's probably more combined than all the other countries combined together. But once again, you got to look at purchasing power parity. In other words, it costs more money to make a tank or aircraft carrier in the U.S. than it does, let's say, in China. But the trends in military spending have been rather substantial. And the problem is with the U.S. is U.S. spending on military defense has fallen, and it's been in a downward trend, except for briefly, under George Bush. And it was in an uptrend under Ronald Reagan, where it approached roughly about 7.5% of GDP, and it has been falling. That was roughly about 1990. And by 2016, military spending in the U.S. had fallen to about 3.3% of GDP. Now, there's been two major downturns in military spending. They occurred under Democratic presidents, Clinton and Obama. When Clinton took office, military spending was about 7.5%. When he left office, it was 4%. Now, let's talk about what happened that brought that down. Remember the fall of the Berlin Wall, and it was the so-called peace dividend. We were no longer involved in the Cold War with the Russians. And so there were dramatic cuts that were made to military spending. I can remember, John, at the end of the 90s, my secretary, her husband was in the Navy, and I spent a lot of time going out on Navy ships. I spent a day on an aircraft carrier, a submarine, and then an Aegis-class destroyer. And I can remember one of the submarines I went out on, they were out of cruise missiles. And a lot of the military was leaving at that time because of the downsizing of the U.S. military. That was corrected after the attacks of 9/11 with George W. Bush. There was an increase in military spending. It went back up to almost 5.5% of GDP, which is where it was when Obama took office. And it dropped down to 3.3% when Obama left office. So we've seen big drops under Democratic presidents. They tend to emphasize entitlements and domestic spending versus defense. But now the trend that we're seeing is there's been several reports that came out this week. One is a report that is must reading, is the perennial review by the Heritage Foundation on the capabilities of the U.S. military. And then also there were several reports. There is the Bloomberg Intelligence Digest about conflicts and possibilities of economic strife and conflict in Asia under Bloomberg Intelligence. That was a big report that came out this week. And then a number of alarming reports going on with military exercises reported in the Wall Street Journal. So the thing that's going on right now is our adversaries are rearming while U.S. is declining. Now, President Trump has vowed to correct part of that in his budget for 2018. He's submitting an increase in military spending of roughly about $54 billion. The problem that you'll have, and we don't have a lot of time to get into detail here, but at one time at its peak, the U.S. Navy had about 600 ships under President Reagan. We are now down to 282 ships, and we've gone down to 10 carrier battle groups. In the Perennial Defense Review, and also published by the U.S. Navy, the Navy is saying to meet its mission requirements, they need 13 carrier battle groups. We're down to 10. And we're basically cannibalizing parts. We can barely keep those 10. So there's going to be a major requirement for increased spending, especially in the Navy, because if you are a global power, as the U.S. is, one of the ways you project that power is through a Navy. And so the Navy is talking about major expenditures required to complete their mission. For example, they say that instead of the 10 carrier battle groups, they need 13 carrier battle groups, 13 new cruisers, 26 destroyers, and 13 attack submarines. A total the Navy needs over 50 ships to take it up from 282. We need to be closer to 350. And so, once again, this is part of Trump's budget for 2018. He's proposing an increase in spending in $54 billion. And part of that is just to compete with basically what's going on in Russia. There was an article this week in the Washington Times. Russia is modernizing its entire military, army, and navy, and they are 50% complete and ahead of schedule of doing that. All of this goal is projected by the year 2020. Also, Russia is also increasing its ability to fight cyber warfare. An article in the Wall Street Journal this week about America is ill-prepared to counter Russia's information warfare. There was another article in the journal about China drifts into a U.S. vacuum in Asia. And then another one, probably most alarming, was a Russian military exercise on the Baltic Sea where 100,000 Russian troops are expected to take part in a military exercise. At the same time, NATO is conducting military exercises in the same region with about 4,000 troops. And so Russia is gradually building up its military in the Baltic region, something they did prior to their takeover of the Crimea.
You know, I was interviewing someone on this recently, and I can't remember who it was. Ironically, it just hit the top of my head. And he said, what we do is after we need our military, then we break it and we wait until the next time we need it again. And then we have to put it back together again. Because when you talked about the peace dividend, remember coming at the end of what was the Cold War, everybody was saying, well, the Cold War is over. We don't need this anymore, blah, blah, blah. And I would raise my hand and go, yeah, but the Cold War had very definite parameters built into it, right? Now those parameters have been destroyed. Where the dust is going to come down on all of this remains yet to be seen. So we were actually in a more insecure time after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union than we were prior to that. And sure enough, that's where we begin to see all the cutbacks. But this is all going on. Now, the Wall Street Journal had an article that Moscow is preparing for wars with the West. And, you know, we always do this in the U.S. We always let everybody else do that. And then we go, oh, gee golly willikers, look what's going on. Look what just happened. Maybe we should do something.
Well, it was amazing because there was a book that was very influential in the 1990s, and it was published by a professor out of Harvard, and that was Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations. And he posited the idea that the next major clash in the globe of global conflict would be the South China Seas. And it's amazing because one of the things that you've seen is a pickup of Chinese aggression, not only with the expansion of their navy, but also in terms of what they're doing in the South China Sea, whether it's conflicts over islands, over its conflict over oil rights. And it's interesting because Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has made a recent trip to Asia. And as a result of missile launches by North Korea, the U.S. is now deploying its THAAD missile defense system in Korea, which is upsetting China. But if you have some kind of crazy guy firing off missiles, you know, this is beginning to alarm countries like South Korea and Japan. And there's also been the hint Tillerson is sort of indicating to China that, look, you're either going to help us contain this, or we may have to consider rearming Japan in South Korea with not only missile defense, but the possibility of nuclear weapons. And so if you are a professional with a Bloomberg terminal, I would recommend that you look at this week's Economic Impact of Asia's Security Risk. This was published by Bloomberg Intelligence, as well as the number of articles in a single week coming out on Russia and China in the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times.
Given the fact that President Trump has been vowing to increase the U.S. military, the Heritage Foundation comes out with an annual index of where they assess U.S. preparedness, and the 2017 report is somewhat sobering.
It really is. They took a look at the Heritage Foundation publishes its perennial review on the U.S. military preparedness, and they talked about our capabilities, and they took a look at Europe, basically with alliances, political stability, and infrastructure. It was very favorable. U.S. military posture, they rated as moderate. They took a look at the Middle East, same for benchmarks, alliances, political stability. Political stability, very poor. Alliances, moderate. U.S. military posture, moderate. Operating environment, the best has been Asia. Alliances are excellent. Political stability, military posture, and infrastructure. This is where a lot of the U.S. has been reconcentrating its force structure. This began under Obama, as Obama began to pivot from the Middle East to Asia. Global operating environment, the Middle East is moderate, favorable in Europe. Then we get to threat assessments, behavior of threats. Hostile, Middle East terrorism. Aggressive, Russia, Iran, China and North Korea, and Afghanistan and Pakistan is probably somewhere in the middle. Capability of a threats, formidable, is Russia. Gathering strength in terms of formidability is Iran, China, and North Korea. Threats most considered vital to the U.S., and they have categories, severe, high, elevated, and guarded. And high is Russia, Iran, China in North Korea. And then what they did is they took a look at, all right, given this assessment, how is the U.S. military positioned? They wanted to take a look at the U.S. military force, the military itself, all branches of government. They started out with U.S. military power. It is weak. The Army has been reduced to nearly 400,000 troops. We need over 550. The Navy is marginal. Air Force is marginal. Marine and nuclear is marginal. Nothing is strong. If you look at the Army, its capacity is rated weak. Its capability is marginal. Its readiness is weak. Then they took a look at the U.S. Navy If you take a look at its capacity, it's rated marginal. Once again, there's a shortfall of roughly about 50 to 60 ships. Its capability is weak. Its readiness is strong. Looking at the U.S. Air Force, strong on capacity, weak on capability and readiness, considered marginal. U.S. Marine Corps, capacity weak, capability and readiness is marginal. And then we looked at our, this is the alarming one, and the President Trump has mentioned this, because Russia and China are modernizing their nuclear capabilities. Our warhead surety, strong. Our deliverability and reliability, strong. Modernization is weak. Our delivery systems, marginal. Our weapons complex are weak. And also marginal is our talent, the force readiness, and allied assuredness. So overall, considered marginal, John. And this is something at a time that it's remarkable. In, I began studying this trend, and I wrote about it in an article I wrote in Inheritance. I was reading the Navy's review of its requirements, and then the Heritage Foundation report that came out. And I'm getting ready to write an article on this. And then you take a look at 1 week, the number of articles that came out on cyber capabilities of Russia, the Zapad military exercises taking place in the Balkans with 100,000 Russian troops, then the article about China in a vacuum, and all of these articles coming out in 1 week. It was just like I was thinking about it, and I'm researching it, and all of a sudden, confirmation coming out in almost 1 week. But I would say this is sort of a mini mega trend. Right now, John, there is a global arms race that's going on, and it's surprising the media has not picked up on this trend.
Except it's not so surprising, because they're involved in this political infighting right now. They're participants in it rather than observers and reporters on it. So their attention is taken in that direction. Now, if we assume that this is the direction where the military status or situation is, how does this affect what you're going to do from an investment perspective? And there are probably several different facets of it, but go ahead and take that question as is.
I would say, number one of the things that is most needed by the U.S. military is to strengthen the Navy. So we're looking at companies that are involved in building ships and warfare systems that go with those ships. Secondly, we're taking a look at cyber warfare, the companies that are involved in there, making the technology. But I would say, number one, the number one defense and one of the most deadliest weapon systems we have are our nuclear submarines. And so the Navy is talking about 13 carrier battle groups. Right now we have 10. We're currently building a new aircraft carrier. And then the other thing that we're looking at is missile defense systems, because our nuclear triad is going to have to be completely modernized. We haven't done this in multiple decades. At the same time, the Russians and the Chinese, the Russians are going through this under Putin, and they had a system. They put together a 5-year plan. They're running ahead of schedule. They're about 50% there. They completely expect that their entire military will be modernized by the year 2020. And right now they're ahead of schedule. It's hard to believe that's only 3 or 4 years away.
How do we stack up against the other powers out there? Because we called this section War and Peace. And remember, Samuel Huntington said the most likely conflict was probably going to be in the South China Seas. But given the strength of our U.S. military, and it still remains pretty good, how do we stack up against our next potential adversaries?
I mean, there is no other military power on the planet, China or Russia, that even compares to the United States and has the ability to take the U.S. on in a conventional warfare. I mean, I'll give you an example. The U.S. has something called an M1 Abrams tank. It's a tank that has never been knocked out by enemy fire. If you take a look at China, will become the largest military next to the U.S. They have 500 tanks. We have 8,700 Abrams tanks. We have 10 aircraft carriers, even though we need 13, but these are called the good kind of carriers. If you take a look at our aircraft carriers compared to the Russians or the Chinese, theirs are more like tugboats. So their carrier battle groups don't even come close to what we have. You take a look at attack helicopters. There's 8,400 attack helicopters. The U.S. owns 6,400 of them. If you take a look at the satellites that guide the GPS system, we own them. If you take a look at stealth technology, we invented it. You take a look at sensors. We invented it. So if you're looking at conventional warfare, any major power, whether it's Russia or China, taking on the U.S., would be like a three-year-old playing a chess champion. But that's right now, John. We are losing a lot of that capability because we're relying on weapon systems that were built and put in place two or three decades. So we're coming out with a new class destroyer. We're coming out with a new aircraft carrier. We've got a new fighter jet that we have. And we're also coming out with a new submarine. So the question is, will the money be allocated? Because there's been severe cutbacks in the last 8 years, both with budget cuts and the sequester. The question is, will Trump get his $54 billion? And that's just not $54 billion for 2018. It's $54 billion every single year, with the majority of that going to weapon systems to modernize our system, just like the Russians and the Chinese. But another mega trend to invest in. And I think the biggest beneficiary is going to be the U.S. Navy.
It seems like we don't have any imminent immediate rate hikes on the horizon or Fed market meetings. So what are we looking forward to in the weeks to come?
Well, we're going to have the LAIs. Of course, next Friday, we'll have the unemployment report. We're going to get GDP numbers for the first quarter, as we talked about in hard data versus soft data. I expect those numbers to be weak, somewhere around 1%. Anything above that would be a major economic surprise. But I would say, John, in the next couple of weeks, we'll probably be, you know, outside politics and what the Republicans or the president does on tax reform, the market's going to focus its attention to corporate earnings, because we're going to get Q1 earnings starting in the next couple of weeks. We're going to look for that trend. It should continue to increase. In other words, it should be a positive quarter or an increase for profit. And we're going to be monitoring those two trends we talked about, what is going on with the financial sector profits and the energy sector profits, which we expect to add to earnings per share for the S&P 500. And that could be the next catalyst for the market. But all of that coming up in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.